This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. We're recording this podcast October 23rd. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Well, Jackie, you know, there's a couple things that we had that was somewhat sacred around our dinner table when I was growing up, and that's the usual don't talk about religion and don't talk about politics. And I guess today it's also, you would say, climate change would be thrown into that mix. Don't talk about any of those three things. But today, I guess we're going to talk about all, well, we're not going to talk about religion, but we're going to talk about politics and a little bit of climate change because they're so interwoven. And I got to say that we're going to talk about the election and the outcomes and so on. And I always try and remain fairly politically neutral, cards close to my chest. In terms of my views and try and be as objective as possible. And so we're going to focus mostly on the policy implications of our recent election. We're going to cover the results, and then we're going to move on to understanding minority governments that are a bit of a refresher. And then finally, and most importantly, we're going to talk about the implications of the minority government to policy, especially energy policy.
Yeah, there's lots to cover. And yeah. I'm sure a lot of people have a lot of questions after the big election results last Monday night. So many of you know Liberals needed 170 to get a majority and they were 13 seats short. So we call this a strong minority. And this can be helpful in some ways because they don't need any one party to support them every time.
Yeah.
Depending on the policy they may want to put in or the legislation that they're talking about, any one of the three parties, Conservative, Bloc, or New Democrats, would provide enough to get a majority vote. If they had less seats, they would maybe be more dependent on one partner and have to compromise more.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody in Ottawa just after the election, somebody in the civil service side of the government, and their view was that this was probably one of the best outcomes because it's a strong minority. You know, if the Liberals had had less, it would have been much more unstable. And when you have an unstable situation in government that's fragile, there's a lot less that could get done and just not a healthy situation for the country.
Right. And it probably means that time will tell here what the Liberals are going to do, but most people believe that they're going to not create like a formal alliance, that they will, on an issue-by-issue basis, pick their partner to work on with the legislation. And so that means all parties can actually really contribute to legislation as it goes forward under this new government.
You mean they might have to collaborate?
Yes, they'll have to collaborate.
What a concept. Okay.
Talk and maybe some compromises will need to be made. So it's not all a bad thing. You know, the Liberals, it was called a victory speech when Justin Trudeau came out after the election, but really they did lose support in most parts of the country. So not a victory from that perspective. The Conservatives did gain seats, but just not enough. And interestingly enough, they did lead the popular vote barely. So the Conservatives, led by Andrew Scheer, got 34.4% of the popular vote, and the Liberals got 33.1%. But as we know, the regional divides are not always population equal. And
no.
So just because you got the popular vote doesn't mean you get the most seats in this case. That was quite a big gap.
No, the seat distribution we know all is just very geographically heterogeneous. It's just dispersed. Actually, you look at the map of the Conservative overlay west of Ontario, and it's just a direct overlay onto the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin geology.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's true. You know, the blue, in terms of the results of this election, actually starts in the middle of BC, right? So, you know, sometimes we think of BC as all left-leaning, but it actually starts, almost cuts right through the center of BC, everything east of that, and then for Alberta and Saskatchewan and the bottom half of Manitoba, you're right. It does follow the Western Sedimentary Basin. It voted Conservative, except for, you know, that one seat in Edmonton.
Yeah, yeah, that one went left-leaning.
Prime Minister Trudeau did acknowledge that division that showed up through this election, especially with the West. Also, Quebec going mostly for the separatist party, the Bloc party.
Yeah, the resurgence of the Bloc.
Is showing another division. We'll get to that around Quebec. But in his victory speech, he specifically said, around Alberta and Saskatchewan, you are an essential part of our great country. I heard your frustration and I want to be there to support you. Let's all work hard to bring our country together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think those were very positive words, very important that he acknowledged the division, I think, in his victory speech.
I think it's really important because this divide has been building and building. And as I said, we're not going to look backwards as to what all the causes for that are. This is where we are at today. And going forward, we've got a lot of work to do. And certainly that type of narrative is what we need. And I'm hopeful that we can enter into some kind of a healing process, because the divisions are literally have the potential to rip the country apart. I mean, we have separatist rhetoric that has started to flare up again in Alberta. I mean, I'm old enough to have known the separatist movements in the 1980s here in Alberta with the Western Canada concept. But back then, it was certainly not as strong as I see it today. And today, there's a lot more people with a lot more money behind this Wexit, Western
hashtag Wexit. Yeah. And I'm sure most of you are aware of that, but you can go see many of the comments, and they really got going after Monday night, for sure.
Yeah. Now, I don't actually think that the Alberta or the West would actually separate. And, you know, we could have that debate over a glass of wine sometime. But I would tell you that it is not without consequence. And I, as an investor, look at this from the outside looking into the country. And if I'm on the outside listening in on Canada and just hearing all this noise, it does not instill a lot of investor confidence. So it's really important that we do enter this period where we sort of calm down. I think that a lot of this flaring up of emotions is probably going to calm down here after the initial results are out, and that we'll move toward some sensibility in terms of the policy. And we're going to talk about that here in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is pretty motivated to keep this country together. And so
it's his job, right? Yeah, I mean, he's the leader of the Federation and what I call the family of provinces and territories. So that is the job of the Prime Minister. And I think the realization has set in Ottawa that this is a big issue, not only here in the West, but now with the resurgence of the Bloc in Quebec. I mean, they are fundamentally a separatist party.
Mm-hmm. So that has to be part of the agenda for the new Liberal government. I wanted to point out a few other interesting regional highlights. Ontario, this is an important area. As we all know, they have swung strongly from a Conservative to Liberal in the past. And while the Ontario map was a little more blue than in 2015, the highly populated urban centers voted Liberal. And this was basically what allowed the Liberals to hold on to power. If that area had flipped to Conservative, as it has sometimes in the past, that would have been the difference in the balance of power.
Yeah. And I think, and you and I have talked about this offline, that bringing climate change into the conversation here, I do think that it was an error on the part of the Conservative leadership to say they weren't going to impose the carbon tax or do something more meaningful about climate change. People in those urban heavy voting districts are very concerned about it. They're chock full of millennials and the next generation who do vote on this sort of thing. And I think it was a real oversight.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think another area that it affected votes is Atlantic Canada, which continued to have strong Liberal support. Now, the Greens were expected to get more support there, but only picked up one seat. But I do think that, and I heard on the CBC, they actually interviewed a number of people from Atlantic Canada that said, you know, they've had big floods like in New Brunswick, and they see climate change as a real pressing issue and need a party that is going to act on it.
Yeah. I mean, you can't ignore it. And politically, I think the people have spoken in terms of their views on that.
Last one I want to talk about is Quebec, because there was a big change there.
Yeah, huge.
In fact, the biggest change in this election, the NDP actually lost 15 seats and the Liberals lost 5, all going to the Bloc.
Yeah.
It's really the NDP that lost that mostly powered the Bloc there.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long ways away from when the NDP, do you remember that orange wave in 2011? They got 59 seats in Quebec with Jack Layton at that time. So NDP has lost a lot of ground in Quebec, and this is by far the biggest reasons why they lost so many seats overall.
It's multitude of reasons. I know we said we wouldn't talk about religion, but you know that Bill 21 was an issue, and I don't pretend to understand Quebec politics, so I don't feel really capable to commentate on it. But the reality is that the Bloc is back. There is a lot of nationalist sentiment, and so now we actually have regional nationalism emerging on the western side of the country and the eastern side of the country, and we've got a big divide, as we said earlier.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not an expert, but I did read an article by Maura Forrest, no relation to me.
Is that two R's?
Yeah, two R's too.
Mm, that's okay.
But anyway, the views in that article were that this is not about separation. It's about representing Quebec's interests more at Parliament Hill, and the dairy issue, I think, is one of them. They also talked about the fact that leader Jagmeet Singh was not well known in Quebec, and the fact that he was turban wearing presents an additional challenge in a province where separation of state and religion is a live issue.
Yeah, so there's that religion issue. But I don't know. I mean, there's degrees of separation. right? I mean, there's a sort of like full separation, or there's just saying, hey, we're not going to play by the rules within Confederation, or we want special treatment or whatever, whether it's in Quebec or whether it's any other part of the country. So I don't know. I actually think it's maybe not a black and white separation, but man, it's a real movement back to polarization of the country.
Okay. Well, with that, let's talk about minority governments. Maybe we're going to have minority governments for a while here if that trend continues. But let's first talk about the history of minority governments, because I think that will help as we think about future policy. Mm-hmm. So history is not always indicative of the future, but in general, minority governments don't last that long. According to CTV on election night, the average duration of a minority was 1 year and 7 months, and the longest individual term was 3 years and 7 months, and it was in 1965. Hmm. So in general, they're not going to last more than a couple of years.
I don't remember that one.
No, neither do I. Neither do I. But the Harper conservative one is the most recent example that we have. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's talked about as being 5 years long, and it was, but it was over two terms. So basically in 2006, when the Harper conservatives, they won the most seats but didn't have the majority, they started their minority mm-hmm. government. Election was called in 2008, and then the Conservatives received yet another minority government. So there was two terms there that gave consecutive period of over 5 years, and that was the longest consecutive minority government mm-hmm. that Canada has had.
Yeah, I mean, minority governments have to work extra hard to ensure that their popularity amongst the broad populace remains fairly robust, because the minute it dips, then they are open to challenge and potential defeat from the other parties. So in this regard, a minority government with 157 seats definitely has to work harder. So I think this is in part why the Trudeau government is much more attuned to the collaborative nature of the comments you mentioned by Prime Minister Trudeau. Oddly, it could be a positive thing in terms of trying to keep things, I guess, dial down the emotions here a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. The minority governments just tend, mm-hmm. because of that, to introduce less new legislation, because it does take more compromise and more support from other parties. And like you say, more support from Canadians. You know, if a piece of legislation is actually very popular with Canadians, the party that votes it down doesn't look that good.
No.
So if you pick legislation that everyone broadly supports, it's less likely that it will get opposition. Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about, you know, the two-year periods. Why is it always 2 years? Well, it generally takes that long before the political parties and Canadians are ready to go back to the polls. They have to raise funds and things like that. Another reason that it is delayed to that period is often the leaders of the parties, or one or two of the parties that don't get to first place, step down. For example, when Harper won the minority government in 2006, the Liberal leader Paul Martin resigned shortly after. And a year later, the Liberals picked up Stéphane Dion to lead the party. So that took like an almost in a year. Then you got to get your new leader to get some popularity and familiarity with the public. So if you don't have a change in leader, arguably that period could be a lot shorter. Mm. If you do have a change of leader in one of the parties, then they're not going to be as motivated to try to bring down the government.
Right, right. Well, there's all sorts of chatter about whether or not Andrew Scheer will stay on. And again, I'm not expert enough to know what's going on behind the scenes to opine on that, but we shall see what happens.
Yeah, and that would just kind of change your view in terms of the duration. Now that we've got those kind of two pieces, that legislation's going to take longer, it's going to have broader support, and there's probably going to be a shorter term for getting things done. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some key pillars of the Liberal energy and environment related platform and how they could evolve considering that minority situation.
So you're just basically going to take it off the platform statements during
yes.
the election campaign?
Yeah. Well, number one was one of the biggest announcements of the election, that the Liberal government wants Canada to be net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050.
So that's everything. Cement plants, automobiles, buildings,
everything.
Upstream oil and gas, everything.
Yeah, like this is pretty, it would require pretty sweeping legislation and change to do that. We would have to get off natural gas in our homes, potentially drive mostly electric vehicles by 2050. So a lot of policy would have to come in over the coming decades.
So we either have to cut our emissions, like what is it, 600 megatons a year?
About 700 million tons per year.
700 million tons per year has to be either cut completely, so that would be like absolute zero emissions, or net zero means that we would have to plant 2 billion trees, which I think is some other platform, which we'll come to.
Plant trees.
Or some combination thereof, right?
Well, another big part of it has to be carbon capture and storage. We talked about that on our podcast last week, getting lots of good feedback, by the way.
Yeah, that was
great. Interest from people on that topic.
Yeah, we encourage you to listen to that one with Kevin J. Bush on the use of the Alberta trunk line and how we're sequestering carbon and actually creating potentially net zero upstream emissions.
Well, and in a scenario where we're trying to get net zero by 2050, I think carbon capture storage has to be a big part of it. Alberta and Saskatchewan could be a big part of the solution because we have the geology to allow a lot of CO2 to be stored. And I think that has to be part of the solution. And there'd have to be a lot of carbon capture storage.
So what do you think? Like net zero by 2050, it's only 30 years away. Is that doable? Like 700 million tons, it's a lot.
I think it would require a lot of carbon capture and storage. And because, as we talked about it, we do have this great basin that would allow a lot of storage, I think it is possible. It would cost money. But we're going to find out more because the Liberals in their platform intend to appoint experts to make a plan for aggressively reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. So they're going to have some experts look at what is a pathway that could get there. Now, I just think, depending on the time of this government, that it's unlikely that would actually get into legislation. Yeah. I can imagine the panel gets appointed, but this is probably a year or two process just to analyze this and come up with a credible plan.
Yeah. I mean, I have to tell you my views is that technically it's possible. The barriers to doing this stuff is not technology. The barriers to doing this stuff is where's the money going to come from to do it? And the social issues around it. Necessarily, it means displacing people, which means unemployment. There's always resistance to change and that manifests itself in many ways from a very human perspective. And a lot of the existing legacy policies are often a stumbling block, whether it's in the electrical power world or other industries. So can it be done? Yeah, it can be done. But it's the stumbling blocks are much more qualitative than quantitative, I think.
Well, and I think one of the other big challenges, you say, how much does it cost? You know, out to 2050, the costs of some of these technologies are going to change, hopefully, and get
down.
More and more economic. And so it becomes very hard to understand what the costs to the economy are.
Yeah.
But, you know, I actually am very interested in this expert panel process. I hope that they do it because I'd be interested to see what
the group
comes up with.
We see what they come up with. But it's a big country. And we know that the carbon emissions are not distributed homogeneously, in other words, equally across the country. And that's another issue, right? We've got major upstream emissions here in the western part of the country.
In fact, 26% of all of our emissions coming from the oil and gas sector as a country.
Right. And then you've got three provinces that are dominantly hydro and completely decarbonize their grid, BC, Manitoba, and Quebec. And so if it was homogeneous, it would be a lot easier, to be honest with you. And so we've got all sorts of, as I say, non-technical issues that need to be dealt with.
Anyway, it'd be really interesting to see what this panel comes up with.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the price on greenhouse gas emissions. This is very important to the Liberal government.
You're being very kind. You mean carbon tax?
Yeah, the carbon tax.
Okay.
Well, this is what it was called in the, I think it was like pricing pollution in the actual platform
it's
document.
It's always changing. Yeah.
Yeah. So they want to price pollution. The Liberals are expected to continue to tax carbon emissions for residential, commercial, and industrial emitters. Industrial emitters do have a slightly different plan, but they are paying at the margin.
Those are like the cement plants and the fertilizer plants and big industrial oil sands facilities, stuff like that.
Yes.
So where are we at now? We're at $20 a ton, and the Liberals have said it's going to $50 a ton by 2022?
Yes. So that's the farthest out they have. I mean, it's possible that with this new government, they extend out the trajectory a little further.
$50 a ton by 2022 is universally on everything. The gasoline, for the consumer, the emissions from an industrial plant, the shopping mall, everything.
Yeah, anytime fossil fuel is combusted, so we create CO2, you have to pay. Mm-hmm. Here in Alberta, we're not paying right now, but the federal government will start charging starting January 1, 2020. When you go to the gas pump here in Alberta, you're going to see some additional costs associated with carbon tax.
So basically, the carbon tax that the Kenney government removed earlier this year is going to be reinstated at a federal level. But it's important to note, I think, is that the tax that's going to be collected is going to be funneled back to the individual provinces, isn't it?
Yes. The Liberal plan is that all the money goes back to the province that it came from and to individuals. And so I don't know how it's exactly going to work, but I think there's some kind of income tax credit that you get through it.
Okay. My head hurts already.
Yeah. I don't know the details. I'm sure we'll all learn about it as we do our tax returns in 2 years' time for this year. So, okay, so we are getting a carbon tax. It is starting January 1. Okay, obviously, one of the very important policies is build the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Yeah. This wasn't specifically in the platform document like that, but it was talks about the fact that they are going to reinvest the money and the profits that they make from owning the pipeline into transitioning Canada to a clean economy. So I think the platform title was more about transitioning Canada to a clean economy, and the Trans Mountain is a key pillar of that because it will support some of that.
That's a lot of money, too. I mean, I've heard some numbers thrown out. It's like $500 million or something.
Yeah, it is a lot of money, and depends on how long they own it in terms of how much profit comes out of it. But you can assume if they are able to build the new pipeline, so we have an existing pipeline, but if they're able to expand that with the Trans Mountain expansion, then the value of that project should be more, and there should be some profit, hopefully, associated with the selling, even if, and that would go towards the clean economy.
Okay, so I ran into somebody yesterday. It's only less than 24 hours after the election. And they said, oh, you know, Trudeau's going to cancel the Trans Mountain Pipeline. So what's the real policy here?
You know, of course, that's a lot of the discussion here in Western Canada. I don't know that we can assume that. I think it's very likely that the Liberals continue to work on the pipeline. And I have a bunch of reasons.
Actually, I just sort of interject. The Trans Mountain Pipeline has passed through Parliament.
True.
Like it's
done. That's one of the first reasons.
So one of these parties would have to come forth and say, and put forth a motion to actually axe the pipeline and say no more pipeline.
They could do on their own, right?
They would need
either the Liberals or the Conservatives.
And the Liberals, I know, are, in talking to people in Ottawa, they are committed to building the pipeline, and they've said that openly.
Oh, yeah. That was a constant talking point during the election, that they are committed to building this pipeline.
I think people need to understand that the issue actually is not in the hands of government. The issue still remains in the judiciary. In the courts.
Right. There's going to probably be legal challenges ongoing. And we had Ian Anderson on our podcast that said he was fully prepared that there would be constant legal challenges through the whole construction period.
Right.
The question is, are any of them successful and do any of them get an injunction on the construction? So that's really the challenge for the pipeline.
That's the challenge. And actually, the role of the government now is to, I think, manage the process of construction, assuming that the courts finally allow it to all go through. And it's going to be a challenge to get it through some of these communities that don't want it, especially in the last kilometer of the pipeline. So that's really going to manage the communications and how it's all done. And, industry is necessarily going to have to be part of that. I don't know. I mean, this is going to be really contentious. This is going to be very, very contentious. But I think it's important to note that the government, Parliament, is highly, highly unlikely to stop what has already been agreed to.
Yeah, and the pipeline is already approved, does not require a vote in Parliament. And as you said, that's a great point that, because of the seat situation, in order to bring forward a bill, either the Liberals or the Conservatives would have to be supportive of it with some other.
The Conservatives are not going to do it.
Yeah, so I think it's very unlikely.
Okay.
Another part of the platform was a series of things around other climate mitigation efforts. So the Liberals pledged to plant 2 billion trees over 10 years in the fight against climate change. I think that when Greta came and Justin Trudeau met with Greta, that was one of the things that he committed to. And I really believe, as you know, if you've been listening to the podcast, in looking about natural solutions to address climate change, I've talked about a number of studies in the past, including this Yale 360 report stating that trees are the most powerful weapon. And planting 1.2 trillion trees, so we've got a few more to go.
Well, what is this Yale 360? Some kind of report?
Yeah, it's a report that Yale University put out, and then the Yale 360 site published a shorter report about it.
Okay, we'll just put that on the website.
Yeah, we can put a link to it. But planting 1.2 trillion trees would store 10 years of carbon emissions, according to their study.
2 billion trees. I think we talked about this on one of our podcasts from way back. That's a lot of trees. Like, I can't fathom a bunch of summer students planting 2 billion trees.
Well, the Liberal platform actually has some details on how that would occur, and there'd be over 10 years they would hire students to plant those trees.
Did you plant trees as a summer student?
No, but my roommate did, and I know it is very, very hard work and not something everyone is apt to do. Not only do you have to fight off the bears and live in a tent in the wilderness, it is tough work for sure. The other things that the Liberal platform talked about is pledges to step up disaster response, along with programs to help with the cost of climate change, such as, you know, when flooding happens, helping homeowners that are affected by these floods. And interestingly enough, most of the platforms, including the Conservatives platform, did have a lot of these elements. For example, the Conservatives talked about plans for reforestation, getting wetlands to be restored, investment in climate change mitigation infrastructure. So there's a lot of commonality on the platforms here. I think a lot of people agree this is the one area that can be invested in that they agree on. Important policies that were evolving and that did not get finished in the previous term for the Liberals. One is the low carbon fuel standard. So this is a pretty complicated policy that the Liberals have been working on for about 4 years, but they weren't able to get it into legislation. But they do have a plan on their website that they would have it in law by 2023. So this is far-reaching legislation and it takes time to do. So I don't know if it will get done in this term. But just for context to back up, what is it? Basically, the Liberals want to say for every hydrocarbon fuel that we use in Canada, that they're going to mandate a certain percent of it needs to come from green sources. So, for example, if we're going to use diesel, a certain percent needs to come from biodiesel, not from hydrocarbon.
What if the upstream hydrocarbons are zero emission?
Well, I think that would count too, actually. Is part of the complications of it.
Yeah, these are the complications, right?
And, you know, if it's coming from that project that we talked about, maybe that would count. Up until now, there really hasn't been that option. The other thing is natural gas. Mm-hmm. Some percentage of the natural gas we consume in Canada would come from biogas that comes, you know, off landfills that is coming from nature.
Well, there's even proposals to take hydrogen from some of our oil fields. There's some technologies that are emerging, and we'll talk about more that. We did talk about it a couple of podcasts ago.
We'll talk about it briefly.
Yeah. I think we should explore that some more, but blending hydrogen in with the methane, the natural gas, into the pipelines, and it significantly reduces your emissions.
Yeah. So again, that could be part of this too. So this is why these are so complicated. I think we've just sort of demonstrated that, okay, if your goal is to reduce the emissions associated with a fuel, there's many ways of doing it, right? These are really complicated policies. Again, they've been working since late 2016. And even if they had a majority, they didn't think it was going to be in law before 2023. So I think this is one that, I don't know if it becomes a priority because it is such a big, large policy. And I'm not sure if it's possible in the time frame with a minority. Okay, last one I want to talk about is, it's called UNDRIP. The United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Give us the background on that.
Some people interpret it as giving them a veto. So if a pipeline wants to be built over their traditional lands, some people say because of this United Nations Declaration that they now have a veto. And if they don't want the pipeline, then it can't be built. Others say it's not that black and white. You know, and so this is one that the Liberals had talked about in the previous election. They had not actually put it into legislation. They ran out of time. But interestingly enough, if you go look at Bill C-69, and I've got some text here from the final bill, it actually does reference it. It says specifically in C-69, whereas the government of Canada is committed to implementing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And so many people believe that even though they didn't get around to putting the legislation in, because it's referenced in Bill C-69, it's effectively in force anyway.
In any way.
So for any new project that falls under C-69, that you would have to follow United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People. And so, you know, are the Liberals going to put in specific legislation as they had planned or not? I'm not sure if it's that consequential. A lot of people feel that it isn't because it's already there.
Okay. So this UNDRIP thing is really a huge subject that we're going to have to tackle almost on a podcast on its own.
I agree. Let's have a podcast on that in the future.
Okay, good.
All right. So, well, let's wrap up our post-election podcast. I think that some of this legislation probably will rise to the top of the Liberals' priority list. I think they will get support from one of the parties on it. But because of the fact that they have a shorter time period, less will get done than what would have happened in the last term. And that, you know, having that collaboration and having to slow down a bit is not necessarily a bad
that's
thing.
That's the top issue. That's the top issue is collaboration on constitutional and confederation issues now.
Good. Well, thanks for joining our podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate it on the podcast app that you use and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.